Okay. So let me begin by thanking the organizers for the invitation. What I will try to do here, I organize some material which is more or less along the lines of what I said at the Solvay meeting in Brussels, with some additions concerning some more recent work. But I will start and I will sort of go ahead insofar as I can go by trying to be clear. So the material here is ideally split in two parts. Is there any pointer that I could use? Maybe I can do it with this.
Let's see.
Okay. So the material is ideally split in two parts. In the first part here, I would like to review for you some very basic and old facts about the formulation of free high-spin gauge fields, starting from the Fitzpauli conditions and going up to the Fronsdahl equations. Then I will proceed to show you some work that I was involved with. And this work has to do with the observation that something was missed in the formulation of the free field equations, namely, the gauge invariance that was displayed in the Fronsdahl formulation was not the full natural geometric gauge invariance of high-spin gauge fields. And then in the second lecture, but as I said, it depends on how quickly we go through this material now. In the second lecture, ideally, I would like to show you how and why string theory motivates this extension and how it, this extension, in fact, plays a role in the only interacting framework that we have now for high-spin gauge fields. These are the Vasiliev equations, which hopefully I will get to at the end. These are constraints on high-spin curvatures. And the amusing fact is that this extended gauge symmetry lies hidden in these equations, although not in very visible form, so that it was not noticed for quite a while. So let me try to go ahead, and please stop me at any time you feel it appropriate so that we can. Now, here's the starting point. The starting point are these Fitzpauli conditions that are supposed to describe the massive degrees of freedom of any spin. Now, of course, here one needs a bit of qualifications, and these qualifications will stay with me throughout this talk, but even the geometric equations that I will show you for high spin have been generalized to more general types of tensors. It's just a bit messier because you have to play a little bit with Young tableau and projectors and the like. For me, loosely speaking, a high spin gauge field will be described by a symmetric tensor in the bosonic case and a symmetric tensor spinner in the fermionic case. The experts know that this is not exhaustive. Rather, it is exhaustive only in four dimensions, up to dualities. In higher dimensions, one needs a more extended set of fields, which correspond to Young tableau of more complicated type in general. But this set of symmetric tensors is an important subclass. And in fact, it is the only class of field for which one today can write fully interacting consistent equations, which is the Vasiliev equations. And in fact, the Vasiliev equations were written in a form which extends their original four-dimensional formulation, which was given in the early 80s by Vasiliev. They were reformulated last year in a way that applies to higher dimensions, which bears a number of subtleties, in particular the fact that this gauge symmetry is realized in this way that I will show you throughout this talk. So the Fitzpauli condition are essentially a mass shell condition, a condition that kills the divergence of the gauge field, and the condition that kills the trace of the gauge field. At the end of the day, if you go to analyze the modes that are described by this equation with these conditions, you are describing essentially massive modes, so you can go to the rest frame if you want of the corresponding particles. If I can go here. Then you put, you stick in the equation this condition for the rest frame. And then effectively what you find is that you're left only with transverse in the sense of taking out the time component for the degrees of freedom and traceless. So these are the Fitzpauli conditions. The whole issue that I will describe for you in the first part of this talk is how to go from these Fitzpauli conditions to an off-shell formulation, to a Lagrangian formulation, which is the Fronsdahl formulation in the massless case. Now, Just to remind you, the fermionic case is similar. You have a Dirac type Machel condition together with the divergence condition and a gamma trace condition. The most elementary non-trivial case is the Gravitino equation, the Rita-Singer equation, which is familiar to most of you. So let me go through this stuff starting from very, very elementary cases, which is massive electrodynamics, the Broca theory. Now, the massive electrodynamics is described by this Lagrangian, and the field equation is the Broca equation. And for spin 2, the natural thing that one would try to do is just repeat this exercise. You see, the Broca equation corresponds directly, in very elementary fashion, to the Fitzpauli condition, to this case, because if you hit it with the divergence, the last term will give you the divergence condition for phi. The coefficient of m squared gives you d dot phi equals 0, then you stick it back and you get the Machel condition. So you get box plus m squared and divergence equals 0. Now, the next exercise you can try to do is repeat this construction for spin 2. So you try to write more or less the same kind of terms, a box-type term, a divergence-type term like before, and a mass-like term. And the question is, does this work? Do you really get the right physical state conditions or the right Fitzpauli conditions? And the answer is not. This doesn't work. You need to work a bit harder, already at spin 2. No matter how easy it would seem, you have to do a little bit more work. And remember, in what I'm telling you, is that the spin 2 field is traceless. So when you have a very Lagrangian of that sort, you don't really get the field itself, but the variation is being traceless. You get a traceless combination. So you wouldn't get phi, but you get phi minus its trace, typically. So this is the field equation that you get. The 2 over d term that you see within the parentheses there is precisely the effect of the traceless constraint on this field. Then you take this equation, and we can play the same exercise as with the Broca theory. You can take the divergence of this equation and find the condition. Remember that for the Broca theory, the divergence was telling you essentially that d dot phi equals 0, that once replaced back in the original equation would give you box plus m squared equals 0, the Mask-Shell condition. Now, if you do it here, remember that, let me stress, in fact, that I left one parameter alpha undetermined. Now, I can take the divergence, and you see that the divergence now includes a higher number of structures. You've generated the divergence of the spin 2 field, which is spin 1, d dot phi nu. You've generated a double divergence, which is now spin 0. And so you really have two independent structures, or rather three, if you consider that you have the box term and you have the m squared coefficient. However, if we take alpha equal to 2, then the first term in the equation in the middle of this slide is killed. And we are left with a linear relationship between one spin 0 component, if you want, d dot phi, the double divergence, and one spin 1 component, the divergence of phi. Now, if one could now add a Lagrange multiplier to this theory, a scalar Lagrange multiplier that eliminates the double divergence, naively speaking, you see this equation, the first term has been eliminated. This term has been eliminated by a choice of alpha. If we can add a suitable Lagrange multiplier to eliminate even the second term, then one is left with the third term that is eliminated. And then its elimination, if you want, also implies the elimination of the double divergence. So in other words, we can recover the proper physical state conditions at the price now of including a Lagrange multiplier. So let's try. We add a scalar Lagrange multiplier with all the couplings. Certainly, the scalar Lagrange multiplier should talk to the double divergence in this form, because that's what it was there for. But we are free to add a kinetic-like term and a mass-like term, all terms which are naturally there in a free theory. Alpha is just a coefficient. You will see that what it will mean when we go later to the massless case, which is a bit more intuitive, because you can anticipate, as you all expect, that the massless case will display gauge symmetry. So alpha will be the natural parameter that displays the gauge symmetry, if you want. However, to go there, it takes a little bit of a redefinition, Because remember that now our field phi to begin with and to abide to the Fitzpauli scheme is taken to be traceless. On the other hand, you will see later that it's more natural to redefine the field, putting back the trace inside. So we will see a little bit very soon where we're getting. So now bear with me that we add the Lagrange multiplier. We take the freedom to add all the other coefficients. And here's what we get. The Lagrange multiplier term is still there in the first line. And now we have two conditions because we have two fields. And remember that alpha was equal to 2 and was eliminating that term from the first equation. Notice that now I'm writing down a 2x2 homogeneous system that links the two spin zero objects that I have at my disposal. The first spin zero object is the double divergence of phi, and the other spin zero object is the compensator, the script phi. Now we have a 2x2 system, and this 2x2 system, we would like it to kill simultaneously the double divergence of phi and the script phi. And the way to do this is to have a determinant which is non-zero. You see, it's a linear homogeneous system in these two variables. However, the determinant in general is a functional box, so it depends on the mass shell. The only way to have a determinant which is identically zero is to make it algebraic. So here comes this Singhagen condition. The Singhagen condition is the condition that the determinant of this linear 2x2 system be purely algebraic. If the determinant is purely algebraic and non-zero, then it sets to zero simultaneously the double divergence of phi and the script phi field. So we are precisely where we wanted to be. Phi has been killed as a Lagrange multiplier, but it has played its role because it has set to zero simultaneously the double divergence of the original spin 2 field. And then, of course, if you go back to that equation which was on the previous page, also the first divergence is zero. So we've recovered the condition, the mass shell condition, box plus m squared on the spin 2 field equal to zero, the first divergence on that field equal to zero, and the trace condition, we didn't need to recover it because it was put in the first place. So this is called the Singhagen formulation for a spin 2 field. You see, it's a little bit convoluted, but it becomes much better when we go to the massless case, which of course is the natural thing to do for gauge fields. Now, if we go to the massless case, then all the terms that are proportional to the mass simply disappear. The equations become those you see in the middle of this page. Remember that in varying the Lagrangian, I still get this 1 over d terms because I'm varying a field which is constrained to be traceless. So this term here is the consequence of varying a phi mu nu, which is bound to be traceless. So you get this equation, and the second one is the condition arising from the field equation of script phi, the Lagrange multiplier. Now, it is not surprising, as was found by Fronsdal in 1960. It's a bit too much of a name for this.
Excuse me, if you want to describe gravity, what changes?
Sorry? That was gravity. The previous, this was gravity. This is Einstein gravity in linearized form. I called it f mu nu because f in general for me would be the Fronsdal operator, and the Ricci tensor is one case of an infinity of operators for symmetric tensors of higher rank, which are the Fronsdal operators. So that's why I'm anticipating the notation. So I'm telling you something that you know in a slightly different notation so far. Now I'm telling you something that perhaps most of you are not familiar with, although it's very simple. Suppose I want to put back masses into this game. The easiest way to do it is to add an extra dimension and do compactification on the circle, but not picking the zero mode. You usually pick the lowest mode on the circle because we want to do low energy physics, ignoring the Kaluza-Klein extension. On the other hand, you pick one of the massive modes, and somehow you do a truncation of these complex fields for higher level in order that the resulting Lagrangian equation would be real. Remember that you would have a whole Fourier series of complex with complex coefficients in an extra dimension. You pick a single term, and you arrange the factors of I so that the truncation is effective and gives you real quantities. And what do you get? For instance, you take electrodynamics in five dimensions, or d plus one for that matter, because we are not bound to be in four dimensions by any means. So you have the Maxwell equation in d plus one dimensions, the gauge symmetry. Let's look at the gauge symmetry, for instance. Then you would have delta A mu equal d mu lambda, and delta of the internal component is derivative with respect to the internal direction. But the internal component is minus I times this extra field, and the derivative with respect to the internal direction picks up, picks a factor IM. Then either the IMY drops out of the equations. So this tells you that the internal, this scalar field for M different from zero behaves like a Stuckerberg field somehow. It shifts with the internal gauge transformation. And with the gauge transformation, and the gauge field transforms as usual. And now the equation that we are effectively writing down are these coupled Maxwell equations with the equation of the Stuckerberg field and the gauge symmetry, the gauge transformation for the, this Maxwell-like field, in fact, Broca-like, I should say, and the gauge transformation of the Stuckerberg field. If now you use lambda to gauge away the Stuckerberg field, then phi goes to zero and you recover the Broca equation. For spin two, it's the same story. You can start from one extra dimension and you will find that the field will contain a spin two part, a spin one part, and a spin zero part. This is standard Kaluza-Klein reduction, but you pick a particular Kaluza-Klein mode, you stick it back, and you will find the gauge symmetry realized a la Stuckerberg for a massive spin two. This is important because it's morally, but not precisely, what string theory does with its massive modes. String theory uses a bit fewer Stuckerberg modes, and as a result of that, it has a critical dimension. So if you want, from this point of view, the fact that string theory displays a critical dimension is because it has not exactly the minimal natural way of Stuckerberg modes. If it had, there would not be no reason, like in this case, to have any constraint on the dimension. So, to summarize, what I showed you so far is the way to include a mass for spin one, spin two, and if you want, by this kind of extension for spin S. And I showed you that the massless case displays some simplicity which was hidden in this Funk-Fronsdahl formulation. If you want to build fields in that way, you will have to introduce all these Lagrange multipliers, but in a way which doesn't have a very easy logic. On the other hand, the logic is precisely given by the Kaluza-Klein reduction from one extra dimension, picking the right modes. Maybe I will skip the details of this transparency. Maybe I can come back to it later. But somehow, let me anticipate that this way of generating masses works for all spins and recovers precisely the structure of this Funk-Fronsdahl construction. So let's look at the first case of an equation which should not be familiar to the main part of you. As this is the Fronsdahl equation for spin three, but if you look at it, it should be very much the natural generalization of what you saw before. Instead of having a two-index tensor, like in the Einstein case, we have a three-index one. Then we have this box term, the single divergence terms, and the double gradient terms. Now, this equation is almost manifestly gauge invariant under those transformations. The box terms cancel the other terms later, and of the second type, but the second term, group of terms generates double gradient terms which are precisely absorbed by the third term. So there is this plus minus plus structure that cancels out terms. The theory is gauge invariant under this symmetrized gradient transformations. And this Fronsdahl operator, this is important to bear in mind, satisfies a Bianchi identity, which is the natural generalization of the equation relating the Ricci scalar and the Ricci tensor in the Einstein's case. Exactly as in that case, the equation that I showed you on top is the analog for this system of the equation R mu nu equals zero for gravity. So it's not a Lagrangian equation, but it can be obtained from this Lagrangian equation for spin three, combining it with its trace. So far everything seems very simple. You go and you have this generalization. However, in fact, I didn't tell you the story really in correct terms, because in this equation I didn't stress one important point. And now let me stress it. In fact, if you are more careful here, you see that in the first equation, this is not quite gauge invariant. Why is it not quite gauge invariant? Because the last term produces some peculiar terms which cannot be cancelled by the rest, and they are not there in the Einstein case. You can almost see it by inspection. If I take the trace of phi in the last term, then the trace of phi from the second transformation, from the gauge symmetry, can produce divergences of the parameter which go away, or traces of the parameter itself. And the traces sit there, they get symmetrized, and so this equation is not quite gauge invariant. It's gauge invariant up to a constraint on the gauge parameter. I don't know if you can see this, but this should be simple to see if you follow this. Maybe I can do it here. Why should I do it on the blackboard? So now we try to be more quantitative, and there is one point that we have to keep in mind. Let's ignore the first two types of terms. Those cancel by themselves. Let me now take the trace in mu and nu of the last expression. So delta phi prime rho, the first two terms give you divergence, so you get 2 d dot phi, d dot delta dot lambda rho, plus d rho of lambda prime. Ignore these terms, that these are okay, but concentrate on these terms. And now you see that these terms appear in three times with folded with the derivatives. So the last term will give you essentially overall 3 d mu, d nu, d rho, lambda prime. So in other words, delta f mu nu rho gives you this expression and is not exactly zero. So this is not exactly zero. It is zero if one constrains the gauge parameter to satisfy a traceless condition. But for the rest, we are more or less okay. Now, what happens if we go to arbitrary spin? Because now we have to find a little trick. And here there's a little bit of identities that we built, but it's a triviality somehow. But it's very convenient because, of course, you can do the spin 3 case with indices, the spin 4 case like that, but at some point you have to invent a more direct notation. The direct notation is to drop indices altogether and to work manifestly with symmetrized tensors. Every tensor is symmetric. Whenever you take a derivative of a tensor, you imagine to take the totally symmetrized combination and so on and so forth. If you do this, then you have a few simple combinatoric identities. For instance, the derivative applied p times, times the derivative applied q times. If you do it naively, you overcount the number of terms, but up to a combinatorial factor, this is the derivative applied p plus q times. Remember that all these terms mean that you apply derivatives and you symmetrize completely because you only work generating symmetric tensors. So now what is the statement? If you repeat this exercise for spin S, then what happens in this notation is that the Fronsdahl term is this one. It's simply written as box of the field minus gradient of the divergence of the field, which is now symmetrized. You see, it looks like electrodynamics, but in fact there's this symmetrization implicit. And then double gradient of the trace. Now, the gauge transformation now is again the symmetrized gradient of the parameter, which I write simply as grad lambda. And then you can derive a number of consequences, more or less along what I did in the blackboard. For instance, the transformation of the divergence of the field involves box of the parameter and gradient of the divergence, which is enough to cancel with the second term. But the transformation of the trace generates terms that cancel and terms that don't. For instance, let me show you how you see it. If you look at the last equation, this shows you the full logic of the cancellation for arbitrary spin. So we can see these equations. Here is the transformation of the first term. It's box of the gradient of the parameter. Here is the transformation of the divergence that, according to this one, contains box of the parameter and gradient of the divergence. And here is the transformation of the trace, which contains the divergence and the gradient of the trace. Now, the only thing you need to use is that gradient times gradient is twice gradient squared. Now you see that this term here cancels precisely this term. The other problem is that gradient squared times gradient is 3 gradient cubed. And now, as I anticipated in the previous page, you see that the F operator, this generalization of Einstein equation for arbitrary spin, is not gauge invariant, but it is so only up to a linearized, to a constraint on the gauge parameter. The parameter is found to be constrained to be traceless. So this is the first Fronsdahl constraint. I didn't like it, and in fact you will see that there is a way to remove it. Eventually I would like to convince you that there is a more general formulation that we are proposing. The other person involved is Dario Francia, that is a graduate student working with me in Roma. And then there is a colleague also in Padua that will be coming up at some point for the compensator form of these equations that I'll mention later. Now, but the main crux of the matter is that for many years people have continued and have gone ahead with this equation, which are perfectly sensible, but somehow they are a partly gauge-fixed version of a more geometric equation that comes up when you remove this constraint.
How many degrees of freedom are present in this field?
The degrees of freedom in four dimensions are a pair, and in higher dimensions correspond. Sorry? In four dimensions, just two, all of them. And in higher dimensions, they correspond essentially to symmetric traceless tensors in transverse space. So there is a number of indices that, a number of degrees of freedom that depend on the dimension. They are given by binomial coefficient, I can show you. Okay? So this is not an issue of degrees of freedom. This is just a partial fixing of the gauge symmetry. So for what we're used to, it's a bit unpleasing now because the field is not in the hands of everyone. But remember that all string theory, all the massive states of string theory are gadgets of this type. So if you want to become familiar with massive modes of string theory, we have to learn this kind of things. And for me, it was not very pleasing nor natural to have conditions like this. But before I get to the point of removing them, I have to go on and show you another condition that Fronsdahl had to impose, which is a bit less transparent, and I will show you why. Here it is.
Sure.
Yes, that will be the second lecture. I will show you that. So if you want to be really plain, I mean, how did I get to understand that there was something behind? Because if you look at string field theory, maybe I'll just make a comment now. If you look at string field theory in this most elegant form in terms of the BRST operator, there is no way the trace conditions enter naturally there. So there must be something going on, and you will see that somehow the tensionless limit of those equations are a real, very nice guiding principle to get from the non-local equations that I will show you at some point, these geometric equations, to their local version in terms of compensators, which are on-shell equations. They are not really Lagrangian equations in a way you will see, up to even the off-shell formulation. And that's interesting because the off-shell formulation, we know it somehow for the free theory, but for the interacting equation, we only know the on-shell. So we're really at the edge of, please.
This might be a naive question, but you read very often that these higher spin fields are inconsistent at the interacting level.
No, that's the point. It's not a naive question. You did well to ask. We know very well that there are interacting equations which are consistent for these fields. They are only for a subset of fields, as I told you before. In the second lecture, I hope to get there. These were written by Vasiliev long ago and very recently generalized to more than four dimensions, because it's not just a matter of technicality. It involves a projection, which is highly non-trivial to those equations. So I hope to be able to tell you something, because that's where I have some very recent results which are to appear soon. And these equations are for a subset of these high spin gauge fields in the form of symmetric tensors. These don't exhaust the story, but I will only refer to symmetric tensors. All I did here, with these geometric equations, was generalized by de Medeiros and Hall and Beckert and Boulanger slightly afterwards. So all I'm telling you for symmetric tensors, insofar as the geometric equation I'll get to hopefully at some point, has been generalized. But I will not do the more general case because it becomes clogging up it complicates the equations, but the essence of the story is present here. Now, the thing I want to tell you, if you want, it's again a generalization, you can take it of the symmetric calculus or playing around with low spin cases and then extending it. Where first of all, we discovered that gauge symmetry is not automatic, right? We need this F operator is not exactly gauge invariant, not automatically so, but we need this constraint on the trace of the gauge parameter. However, Fronsdal has another constraint, which is even more strange. The gauge field in his equations should be doubly traceless. So not only not a single trace should vanish, but a double trace. How do you justify this constraint? Well, to make the story short, what happens is that these equations carry a Bianchi identity for this F operator. This F operator, remember, is the generalization of the Ricci tensor. The Ricci tensor satisfies an equation according to which the divergence of Ricci minus half the trace of Ricci is zero. This is true only for low spins. If you try to repeat the exercise for higher spins, what happens is that there is some sort of a classical anomaly in this Bianchi identity that involves the second trace of the gauge field. Now, I anticipate partly some points to which I will come back later, but maybe I can tell you here directly. Let me state why this is important. Suppose you write down a field equation, and you imagine to have derived this equation by varying a Lagrangian. The variation of a Lagrangian will be the variation of the field times the field equation, and the field equation is not F, but it's somehow F minus 1/2 eta F prime. Remember, because there is this issue of the integrable equation. Now, so if this is the field equation, if this is the Lagrangian equation, the variation of the Lagrangian should be of this form. But now, suppose that you choose this variation to be a pure gauge transformation and you integrate by parts. This should be zero, right? Should be zero because it's the gauge symmetry of the Lagrangian. If you integrate by parts that gauge variation, then the derivative will hit F and will produce a divergence. And therefore, the gauge variation here of this field that is sitting on the side, or if you want the specialization of this to a gauge transformation, should give you zero. And it can do so only via the Bianchi identity of this operator. However, I'm showing you there that the Bianchi identity contains this anomalous piece. Therefore, in order to ensure gauge symmetry of the Lagrangian in this formulation of Fronsdal, you need to constrain this double trace to vanish. If this double trace vanishes, then the Fronsdal-Lagrangian is gauge invariant. So to reiterate, the Fronsdal equation is gauge invariant if the parameter is traceless. The Fronsdal action is gauge invariant due to this anomalous behavior of the Bianchi identity if the field is doubly traceless. Okay? So this is the point. So what are these Fronsdal equations then? Once more I reiterate. The Fronsdal equation is this generalization of the Einstein equation, box of the field, minus gradient of the divergence of the field, this means totally symmetrized, plus double gradient of the trace, totally symmetrized, equals zero. And the constraints are two. The parameters should be traceless, otherwise the field equation is not gauge invariant. And the field itself should be doubly traceless, otherwise the Lagrangian is not gauge invariant. Granted these two constraints, the Lagrangian takes this very simple form. Of course, it's a free theory and cannot be very complicated, but on the other hand, it's true for all spins. So the simple form is due to the compact notation that allows you to manipulate the whole story, and you have this very limited number of couplings. How much time do I have? I didn't take care to...
20 minutes.
Okay. Let me now move to fermions. The first non-trivial case we all know about. It's the spin 3/2 case, the Gravitino equation, the Rarita-Schwinger equation. Now, the Rarita-Schwinger equation, it's written usually, maybe not in four dimensions where you can present it with an epsilon tensor, but it's written usually in terms of these antisymmetric combinations of gammas. Gamma mu nu rho means the product of gammas if they are different and zero if they are equal, so it's the antisymmetrized product. However, if you take the Rarita-Schwinger equation and you hit it with a gamma matrix, in other words, if you take its gamma trace, then it has, as a consequence, the equation on the right-hand side. That's simply the gamma trace of the previous one. Now, then use this little identity for anti-symmetrized gammas, if I can ever get there with, here it is. The triply anti-symmetrized gamma is the product of a single gamma times a double gamma up to eta terms, okay? So apply to the Rarita-Schwinger equation, the triple gamma term fold into the curl of psi is equal to gamma mu times the double curl, times the double gamma folded into the curl, minus the other terms. Okay? Now, you see that essentially the second term can be killed by the second condition, and then you basically reduce the original equation, which contains the triple gamma, to an equation that contains single gammas. So in other words, this is the term that would be zero once it's folded onto the curl. This is zero by the condition on top, and then you're left with these two terms. What do they read like? The first one is a Dirac type term, and the second one is the gradient of the slash of the gauge field. Now, you will see that this structure persists to all orders in spin. So all the highest spin equations for fermions are precisely of this form. You will see there are this slash of a spinor tensor minus the symmetrized gradient of the slash of the spinor tensor. Now, for spin 3/2, the equation is gauge invariant. Of course, this is the Rita-Schwinger equation written in different form under this gradient transformation, which is a supersymmetry transformation. It's the beginning of supergravity, if you want. Okay? So this is the spin 3/2. Now we can try to proceed and see whether we can manage for spin 5/2. And not quite. For spin 5/2, we try the natural extension of that term, which is this slash now of a symmetric 2-tensor, which also carries a spinor index. That's a spin 5/2 field in this canonical form. And then we add the generalization of what we had before. So the symmetrized gradient of the slash of the gauge field. Exactly like it was in the Rita-Schwinger case, apart from the symmetrization. We perform the gauge variation, and now there is a novelty, namely that the gauge parameter is also a spinor vector, and the gamma trace of this object can appear in the gauge transformation. And the result you find is precisely that the gauge variation of this object, S mu nu, is not zero, but is proportional to the gamma trace of the gauge parameter. So you reason like Fronsdahl before, and you constrain the gauge parameter to be gamma traceless. So that's the beginning of the Frank-Fronsdahl form. There is this reference to Fratkin that I could not even sort out from Vasiliev himself. He was a student of Fratkin. But this is it has an historical interest, because apparently Fratkin worked out this spin 5/2 equation, and then the other people liked it very much, and they hired him. So that was the beginning of his career that ended up at Lebedev. But the precise date I couldn't find, because it's a long time ago. Now, we can repeat the exercise now. Symmetric calculus, so we ignore the indices. We work with symmetrized tensors. The S, this Frank-Fronsdahl operator, is I times D slash psi minus D psi slash. The gauge variation of psi is D epsilon. And then what happens? Completely in exactly the same way as before, the 2 is the result of having D times D, which is 2D squared by these combinatoric rules. The variation of S is not zero, but is proportional to the gamma trace of the parameter. Hence, if one constrains the gauge parameter to be gamma traceless, we are done, at least we are half of the way through, the equation is gauge invariant. But then there is another little issue. What does the Bianchi identity do? Remember that the Bianchi identity would be what will guarantee the gauge symmetry of the action by an argument, which is just the fermionic analog of what I showed you on the blackboard there. Now, to cut the story short, the Bianchi identity for fermions is slightly more complicated, but not so much. And here I have an error. This term should be a half in front. I apologize. So the Bianchi identity is the divergence of S minus 1/2 the gradient of S prime minus 1/2, not 1 like there, D slash S slash. And again, there is an anomalous term, a term that doesn't show up for low spins, but it comes up from certain spin onward, namely from spin 7/2 onward, because you need to be able to take a trace, therefore eliminating a pair of indices, and then a gamma trace eating up the third. But from that point on, there is a second constraint, namely that the trace of the gamma trace of psi should be zero, or since psi is a symmetric tensor, a trace is the equivalent of 2 gamma traces, and therefore you have a condition that the triple gamma trace of psi equals zero. This is the second Funk-Fransdahl condition, and granted this pair of conditions, then you have gauge invariant actions and gauge invariant equations. Here I will skip it. This is sort of tell you that by this Kaluza-Klein trick for fermions, then you can get all the proper masses directly without going through this Funk-Fransdahl construction, which is very counterintuitive. Now, let me show you how one goes about removing these constraints. I will do it in the spin 3 case, which is really contains half of the difficulty, because the spin 3 case, I remind you, involves this constraint for the trace of the gauge parameter, but is not rich enough to see the constraint arising from the Bianchi identity. So there's no constraint on the gauge field now. But there is a constraint on the gauge parameter. And now the constraint of the gauge parameter is relatively simple to see. The Fransdahl operator for spin 3, I call the indices 1, 2, 3 here, varies into the cube gradient of the trace of the gauge parameter. But now the indices are fixed. So 1, 2, 3, read it as mu 1, mu 2, mu 3, whatever they are. They're not. Now, you see that you can take, if you take the trace of phi, then what will happen is that the trace of phi, for instance, in this index 1 and 2, will create a box of lambda prime. The divergence will create a box squared of lambda prime. So this d dot f prime varies into 3 times the box squared of lambda prime. Then divide by box squared and remultiply this expression by the cube gradient. And you see that this expression, this non-local expression, has exactly the same gauge transformation as f itself. Therefore, f minus this is fully gauge invariant. So in other words, you see that there is a funny story that's coming up, that you can make the equation fully gauge invariant, but you have to make it non-local. You shouldn't worry about that, because I'm extending the gauge symmetry, and the extended gauge symmetry is such that if I gauge fix partially, the non-locality disappears. However, the advantage of this is that the gauge symmetry is completely unconstrained. The second advantage is that the structure of the Fransdahl equation is the following. Think of it this way. The Fransdahl operator is, in general, box of the gauge field minus gradient of divergence of the gauge field plus the gradient of the trace. So roughly speaking, this term is built out of a spin S object, this field. This is built out of a spin S minus 1 object, and this is built out of a spin S minus 2 object. Now, you see that S minus 2 is 0, the lowest spin possible for gravity. But somehow, for higher spins, you are missing the lower spins in the field equation. You are missing terms of lower spins in the field equations. And this is the origin of the constraint. A three-term field equation is a two-derivative field equation, but the lower spins are missing because you don't have them, because it's part from S, S minus 1, S minus 2. And so for S bigger than 2, you are missing a chain of lower spins. You can reinsert a chain of lower spins. One possibility is this one, and other equivalent possibilities which map into each other upon traces and combinations are these ones. But you have to do it at the expense of introducing a spin zero term, which just by derivative counting contains a 1 over box. The question is, what do you gain by this? And I will show you that you gain something from a conceptual viewpoint, because it displays the geometry that is hidden behind these field equations. But we have to work a little bit to get there. Now, it is a very simple step, once one adds this term, to write down a fully gauge invariant equation with an unconstrained parameter. And now, these terms here are the non-local terms that you add. The next step that I will show you later is that these non-local terms can be eliminated and traded for local terms, adding a compensator. So for spin 3, there will be a single scalar compensator that will eliminate these non-local terms. For spin S, to anticipate, there will be a single spin S minus 3 compensator. However, that will not be enough to give you a Lagrangian. They will give you equations of motion which are consistent, like the Vasiliev equation, not surprisingly in a sense, because the end of the talk next time will show you that the two ideas link. But if you want to go and build a Lagrangian for higher spins in a totally gauge invariant way, you will need of order S compensator fields, and again, string theory and some generalizations of it are a very nice guide through this process. But that will be next time. In the time that is left, I will show you a little bit how one can go about rephrasing this argument and generalizing it to all spins. The way to do this is to produce an induction argument. And the argument by induction goes like this. Let F1 be the Fronsdahl operator, and we can now build a sequence of pseudo-differential operators, which I name Fn here. So F1 is the Fronsdahl operator, and I can play the same kind of game that I played for spin 3. So you take this operator, you combine it with the double gradient of its trace, which has the same spin, or with the gradient of its divergence. But in order to have the right number of derivatives, you have to divide by box. And each iteration here leads you from a field Fn to the subsequent field Fn plus 1. You keep on iterating, and you gain something because, by construction, of course, there's no gain because we imposed it. The gain will come later. By construction, what comes out here is that the field, like the Fronsdahl field, F1, was varying, was not gauge invariant. The Fronsdahl, sorry, operator, Fn, remember, is F1 is that expression. I call it the Fronsdahl operator. Fn is the nth iteration, or rather, n minus first iteration of this thing. Like F1 was varying into lambda 1, here lambda 1 stands for the trace of the gauge parameter, so F2 will vary into the double trace of lambda, F3 into the triple trace of lambda, and so on and so forth. Now, you realize that you cannot take trace as much as you want, because for any given spin, the gauge parameter will carry a certain number of indices. At some point, the traces don't exist anymore, and at that point, you are done. You have achieved gauge symmetry. Example. Suppose you are at spin 4. At spin 4, the parameter carries 3 indices. I can take a trace. I will have some object with one index, but the next trace is 0 algebraically, because I cannot take the double trace of a spin 3 object. So on for other. So at some point, this iteration stops, and this operator Fn plus 1 is the least singular operator which contains which has this feature of being absolutely gauge invariant. However, and this is the formal way to see it, in a way that should remind you of the notation of string field theory, because ddxi is the analog of an alpha destruction operator, and the xi's are the analog of an alpha creation operator. So read xi mu e alpha minus 1 mu, and ddxi mu alpha 1 mu, and then you should see that it's something reminiscent of what you have seen in string theory. But it's also reminiscent of what's going on in high spin gauge theory, as you will see later. Because these objects are building up, essentially, they have a star product algebra that builds up the gauge generators out of these commutations. But anyway, to cut the story short, what I showed you before, this iteration can be written in this form here. The product of these pseudo-differential operators in this extended space, xi and x, if I can ever get this thing there, here it is, acted on F1, which is the Fronsdahl operator, will be your gauge invariant field equation. Now, it takes a little bit of work. I cannot show it to you on the blackboard, but bear with me. It can be shown that, barring the fact that I change notation, that here in the last equation F should look like F1, for all spins, this equation can be presented in this form. F1, or F, equal 3 times, so some coefficient, say, times the cube derivative of another object, which is a non-local, which is, in this case, a non-local compound of the field itself, at 1 over boxes and all the like. However, so you can show that this equation can be always combined in this form. However, what happens is that by consistency, then this H behaves like the compensator field for the trace of the gauge parameter, because remember that F varies into d cube of lambda prime, factor 3 d cube of lambda prime, and by consistency, this composite object, this non-local composite of the field, this 1 over boxes, has to vary into 3 times lambda prime. You will see that, nicely enough, the local compensator form of this equation will take exactly the same form, but with H, in that case, another independent local spin S minus 3 compensator. So if you want, what I'm showing you now is a minimal description of these fields in terms of a single object. If you add another object, the equations become local. So this field H, the role of this field H will be played by another spin S minus 3 field. But now let me show you, just we're approaching the end of this talk, I want to show you what we gained. And this is what you gain. Remember that I added these extra terms to F, generating this sequence of pseudo differential operators, and not surprisingly, I was improving matters. No? We were getting terms which were more and more gauge invariant, if you want, whose gauge transformation was carrying higher and higher traces of the gauge parameter. This was imposed. What we do gain at zero price is the similar corresponding modification of the Bianchi identity. For n equal 1, you have the Bianchi identity that we have for the Fronsdahl operator. Divergence of Fronsdahl minus a half gradient of Fronsdahl prime equals something which involves the double trace of phi. If you iterate, at the same time, the Bianchi identity keeps on being violated. I call the Bianchi identity the left-hand side, and the red part I call it the anomaly. It keeps on being there, but it's there at higher and higher order in traces. So at some point, it doesn't exist anymore. For instance, suppose you take n equal 1, then the n equal 1, the Fronsdahl case, will be violated by the double trace. But take n equal 2, then it will be violated by the triple trace. For spin 4, the field has 4 indices. Remember that the parameter had 3 indices, and the double trace was impossible. The trace of please bear with me, I'm getting confused. For spin 4, the field has 4 indices. The parameter has 3 indices. If I do the first iteration of the field equation, I don't get F1, but F2, the first non-local equation, that would involve the double trace of the gauge parameter, which doesn't exist. At the same time, the Bianchi identity would involve the triple trace of a spin 4 field, which doesn't exist as well. So you see that with a single iteration, not only do I get the field equation, which is gauge symmetric, but I also get the Bianchi identity, which is not violated, and hence a Lagrangian which works. So in other words, for spin 4, a single iteration of this procedure will produce, to reiterate, at the same time, a field equation generated by what I called F2, which will be gauge symmetric, because I would be have to take the double trace of the gauge parameter that for spin 3 doesn't exist. And the Bianchi identity, and hence the Lagrangian, Bianchi identity, which is symmetric, again, without this violation, up to triple trace of the gauge field, which doesn't exist as well, and hence a Lagrangian, which is gauge invariant. All you need to do is work a bit harder now to find an analog of the Einstein tensor. This G is the analog of the Einstein tensor in this case. And for spin 2, the Einstein tensor is simply Ricci minus 1/2 eta times scalar curvature. Here you have more combination. You have to take double traces and multiple traces. But up to some combinatorics, you get it. And you can show that this Bianchi identity implies that Gn is divergenceless. If Gn is divergenceless, then the analog of the Einstein equation, G mu nu equals 0, for higher spins is simply G equals 0. And the analog of the Lagrangian is simply phi times G. And that's completely unconstrained insofar as field and gauge parameter are concerned. How much time do I have? Then I'll stop here. I don't know, what do I have here? No, I'll do it next time then. Okay.
Okay, we have time for one question.
Okay, sure. Here it is. But there are 2 slides. And then I'm cheating with the time. I can do it upon request. With pleasure. Now, what I wanted to say about geometry, should I go ahead or not?
It's a question, so you're allowed.
Okay. So the question is the following. Suppose you take a particle physics attitude toward Einstein gravity. You know, you linearize the equation, and you try to understand, from this point of view, what is the meaning of the Christoffel connection. Well, the meaning of the Christoffel connection is this nice descent. Namely, that the gauge variation of H mu nu contains 2 terms, as many as the spin. And the Christoffel connection is some peculiar combination of these terms, which at the price of including an extra derivative shrinks the 2 terms to 1. Hence, when you hit these 2 terms with a curl, you get 0, because the curl of the gradient vanishes. And that 0 characterizes the Riemann tensor, which is gauge invariant. So there is a generalization of this story for all spins. And the generalization of this story for all spins was done worked out long ago by DeWitt and Friedman that built a sequence of Christoffel-like connections which have S indices in the place of the two indices sitting here for the Christoffel connection, read them here, the news. And in fact, a chain of connections of this type, which have one, two, up to n minus, s minus one indices in the first set. For gravity, it's a bit unique. I mean, you have two here and only one here. For spin s, you have s here and then one, two, three, all cases, up to s minus one. So you have really a chain of connections. But somehow the analog of the Christoffel connection is the one with s here and s minus one here, to some extent. Then there is also another daughter field, which has s here and s here. That's the gauge invariant object. That's the generalization of the Riemann tensor for higher spins. And by construction, you can see that it carries s derivatives. Okay? Now, what they went even further. They showed that if you take this connection here, the particular connection, which has two indices here, and hence two derivatives in its definition, and you trace it in the first two indices, then you get the Fronsdahl operator. And there they stopped. And now, what I'm proposing you here is that what I did is this generalization of the Maxwell-Einstein equations. The Maxwell equation is the divergence of a two-tensor. All the odd spin equations that I showed you before with these non-local terms are nothing but the expansion in terms of the Fronsdahl basis, if you want, of the Fs and this particular structure. You take this Riemann tensor, Riemann-like tensor, which has S indices on the first group. Now they are 2n plus 1. S is 2n plus 1. And S indices in the second group, you trace n, 2n of them. So you take n traces, you take the divergence with respect to the remaining one, you divide by power of box, which is related to the spin. The spin n is 2n plus 1 in this case. And that's the odd spin equation that I showed you. And for the even spin case, then the equations that I showed you, this non-local equation, that the generalization of Einstein's equation, you divide by some power of box, you take the trace over the 2n first indices, you leave the other ones floating there, and that's the other equation. Let me stress one point, because it will come to your mind. The Riemann tensor is written usually anti-symmetric and anti-symmetric. Here, there is another combination. There is another basis in which you can work with fully symmetric tensors in the two sets. That's the basis I'm referring to. They are linearly related. So these objects are manifestly totally symmetric. So this is the geometry part. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, let's thank Augusto again. We shall come back at 15 to 12.
Since I spotted it now, then I forget.